It's my pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Yitzhak Etshalom. Rabbi Etshalom was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. He attended Yeshiva Keren B'Yavne. He also attended Reitz and the Gush Haratzion before receiving smicha from the Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim. He's been teaching in L.A. since his return there in 1985. Is a remarkable ability to communicate Jewish ideas and Jewish learning to young people as well as adults. He's an accomplished storyteller. He's a radio host. He's a songwriter. He's got tapes of his own music and his own stories. His first book, called Between the Lines of the Bible, was published a little under a year ago by Yashar Books, and he serves on the faculty of the Yeshiva of L.A. and the Simon Wiesenthal Center as the Associate Director of Project Next Step. And he's also the chair of the Bible department at the YU High School in Los Angeles. He lives in L.A. with his wife and five children. Won't you please welcome Rabbi Yitzhak Etshalom.
Thank you, Elliot. Baruch Hashem, I get about an hour to rebut that. I just came in from L.A. a couple hours ago, and I just want to ask you all one question, something that's been confusing me since I landed. What is that white stuff on the side of the road? In L.A., we would call out the EPA and assume that there was some toxic dump. The topic that we're going to deal with is a very focused topic, but Baruch Hashem, we have the flexibility to expand not only our study this morning into the question of why Mordechai did not bow down. I'll tell you why I chose that topic for today, the day after Tu B'Shvat. It has a particular halachic significance, but it will afford us the opportunity to look at several general approach issues in how we study narrative in Tanakh, and specifically how we study Megillat Esther. I'm going to make a shameless plug at this moment. At the bottom of the page, you can see that there is a URL, www.shalom.com/podcast. Last week, I began podcasting a series of lectures on Megillat Esther, which is, what? Oh, yeah, there's a handout. It should be coming around. If not, then lodge a complaint, because it should be there. And there should be plenty. And it is directed to a general audience. Okay? Good. There should be some more of them. No. Perhaps if somebody wants to go ask Dr. Malamuth, I'm sure he... Do we have more handouts? I think some people... Two. Okay. The point of that series and what we will be trying to focus in within about an hour's time this morning is how we properly should be reading and studying Megillat Esther. And of course, that comes down to a whole bunch of specific questions, only one of which we'll be dealing with here, which is the question of why Mordechai didn't bow. But it also takes us to larger questions about how to read the narrative in Tanakh. The first thing that we need to do in order to understand how to approach this question, how to approach the Megillah, is to understand that Megillat Esther works as a text on two very different levels. It works as a text for the Yahoo who is stuck somewhere between Hamilton and London and has to pull over because of, what do they call them? Snowstorms. I was just introduced. And pulls into, I don't know if you have a Motel 6 or Super 8 or Econo Lodge, and the cable isn't working, and he doesn't read much, and he pulls out from the nightstand the book, and he thumbs through it, and he finds the book of Esther. And reading the story of Queen Esther, the story beginning from chapter 1 to chapter 10 is a story that hangs by itself. It flows. It begins. It ends. It has drama. It has tension. It has a lot of satire. It has a lot of humor, a lot of irony. And it is a story that can be read out of context, again, by the Yahoo out of Hamilton. However, the text also works on a much more profound level to those of us who are grounded in the Tanakh, and especially if we are reading it in the original. A very important methodological note to make about Megillat Esther specifically and about Tanakh in general. The authors of Tanakh, guided as they were by either divine inspiration, by prophecy, depending on which book of Tanakh we're speaking about, were as familiar, if not more familiar, than their audiences with books that already existed. The author of Sefer Shmuel knew Bereshit far better than we know Bereshit. And as a result of that, the author of Sefer Shmuel, as an example, used terms, allusions, settings, etc. in Bereshit to make a particular point. Okay, one case in point, and I'll be elaborating on this at the second lecture in the afternoon, is I'm going to tell you a story and tell me who it's about. There is a man who marries a woman, and strange as this sounds in the Jewish world, he doesn't get along with his father-in-law. Such things don't happen in our community, of course, but in the ancient world they happened. The girl has to make a very difficult choice between siding with her father or siding with her husband. In the end, she sides with her husband, earning the recrimination and anger of her father, and she does so utilizing fertility gods. Who are we talking about? Rachel, Michal, you're right. Thank you. The story in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yod Tet, of Michal sneaking David out the window and doing what, when I talk to my high school students, this is already too old for them, but doing the Ferris Bueller scene where she has a bunch of things in the bed looking like David's there. So when Shaul's guards come, they think David's still in the house. And in the meantime, she stuck him out. What did she put in the bed? She put idols, trafim. And when her father came and got angry at her, why did you help my enemy? Then it's your husband. So she came up with some lie. Well, he threatened my life. She sided with her husband against her father, earning her father's hatred. Rachel did the exact same thing. Rachel hid the trafim, lied about them, said, I can't get up because, etc., etc., sided with her husband over her father. What is the purpose of the author of Sefer Shmuel using the exact same term as trafim and describing that scene with such elaborate detail? Well, the advantage is one that perhaps we're not so happy about, but it paints Shaul as a latter-day Lavan. And we'll talk about that in the afternoon. But this is a common style within the Tanakh. And by the way, it doesn't start in the Nevi'im. It starts in Chumash. I'll give you two examples right away. The Torah specifically talks about discrimination within the family and prohibits a man who has two wives and he favors one, but the eldest child is born, the Bechor is born to the less favored wife. The Torah prohibits that man from transferring the rights of the firstborn and whatever financial gain he has to the child of the beloved wife. He has to give it to the firstborn, regardless of who the mother is. That seems to be a very clear comment on the behavior of Yaakov, Reuven, Yosef. Another example. There's a man, goes on a fateful journey, designed to do something terrible to the future of Am Yisrael. Sets out in the morning, takes a donkey, takes two boys with him, and is about to do an awful thing that will destroy the future of Am Yisrael. And at the fateful moment, an angel comes and stops him, and instead, the curse turns into a blessing. Who are we talking about? You're right. You're right. The story of Bilam is, if you will, a commentary on the Akedah. It's a response to the Akedah. Because remember, by the time the story of Bilam happens, the Akedah story is one that we know. It's one that we've already heard at Har Sinai. And therefore, it's not so much the question of did it happen or didn't it happen. Of course it happened. But once something happens, the way it's described, the words used, the issues that are focused upon, the facts that are relied in and the facts that are stressed, tells you that the author is trying, in this case, author capital A, is trying to create an association between these two scenes, between these two characters. Is it any surprise then that Chazal and Pirkei Avot set as contrasting figures Avraham and Bilam. Somebody who is miserly and who is haughty is a student of Bilam, and the exact opposite is a student of Avraham. Because the text already did that. The text already drew them together and said, look how different they are. So this is a common thing. It becomes extremely common within Megillat Esther for one simple reason. Megillat Esther is one of the last books of Tanakh, which means it got all Tanakh in front of us, excuse me for treating it lightly, but to play with, to utilize, to take advantage of, to take figures, scenes, events, emotions, and to echo them, to draw them together as perhaps a way of distinguishing them. I'll give you an example right away. The Gemara Megillah, Masechet Megillah, observes that at the beginning of the second chapter of the Megillah, it's not on our text, just as a way of introduction, that when Vashti was devashtitized, I don't know what happened to her. Do you know what happened to her? I don't know what happened to her. She's no longer queen. She could be dead. She could be cleaning toilets. She could be in exile. I don't know. She's not queen. When the king wakes up from his anger, the kids say to the king, the courtiers say to the king, we should seek out all the beautiful women in the kingdom, the beautiful maidens in the king, in the kingdom, and bring them to the king. Yivakshu l'melech narot tavot p'tulot mare, p'tulot tavot mare, etc. Exactly using the same phrase that shows up where? Melachim where? The very beginning of Sefer Melachim and the Book of Kings, when David is old, and he's cold, and he's not getting any warmth. His courtiers say we should seek out the beautiful young maidens in the kingdom, and one of them comes, and that's of course the beautiful Avishag HaShunamit, who becomes a consort to the king, not in the fullest sense, according to the text, but in a sense, and keeps the king warm, and she keeps his company, and becomes the focus of a big battle after the king dies. Now, what do Chazal do with the comparison? They say, imagine, if you will, the word goes out in Israel that the aging, dying King David is looking for a consort. Every mother brings her daughter to Yerushalayim. And now imagine for a moment, if you will, that the blowhard, fat, ugly, because this is what Chazal do with him, drunken, silly, buffoon Achashverosh, which by the way, he was none of those. Get to that. But that's what Chazal describe him. Imagine this man who, when he is angry, snaps his fingers and Vashti is gone, which by the way is not true either. What did Achashverosh do when he was really, really, really angry? Achashverosh is the first model for a Jewish communal head. What did he do when he was really, really angry? Called a meeting. Asked his advisors, what do I do? I don't want to break the law. What's the law? And what's really funny is, he says, what has happened in the past when a queen has publicly disrespected her king? And unfortunately, the advisors have to say, we got precedent coming. Never happened before. So then somebody comes up with the advice that he does. That's part for another shiur. But the way Chazal described it is, imagine, if you will, any mother hearing that Achashverosh is looking for a wife. What does she do? She hides her daughter. In other words, the authors of the Megillah are utilizing the same terminology in describing the seeking out of a wife for Achashverosh as was already there and canonized and known throughout the nation in seeking out a wife for David, to draw the two together so that we can imagine right off the bat how different they are. Now, by the way, the reason that this is so available is that every conversation that takes place in Megillat Esther is a translation. There is no single conversation in Megillat Esther between two Jews. So even if you want to assume that the Jews in Persia spoke Ivrit to each other, which there's no reason in the world to assume that. At best they spoke Aramaic, they probably spoke Farsi. And that we're going to talk about in a little bit, about assimilation and who the figures are. But even if you want to argue that they spoke Ivrit to each other and quietly whistled Hatikva when they passed each other in the street, Even if you want to argue that, there is not one single conversation in the entire Megillah between two Jews, which means every conversation that's there is taking place either in Farsi, or more than likely, sorry, I come from L.A., Farsi is like the local language. That's Persian. Or in Aramaic, which was the international language. Which means that when the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the final editors of Megillat Esther, write down the conversations, they're translating. And what do you get to do when you're a translator? You get to choose which words to use. Aha, we're going to take a line right out of Malachim Aleph so people will then see Ahasuerus versus David. This is a critical piece. Yeah. Nope. Mordechai speaks to Hatach, who speaks to Esther. And Esther speaks to Hatach, who speaks to Mordechai. Gotcha. I mean, that's the closest it comes. Now, if you want to accept the Midrash that Hatach is Daniel, which is historically impossible, but anyways, if you want to accept that Midrash, nonetheless, they still have to keep up appearances. And again, the whole question can only start if you assume that the Jews in Persia were speaking Hebrew to each other. I got news for you. The Jews in Israel weren't speaking Hebrew to each other. They're already speaking Aramaic. Perhaps they're speaking Yehudit. By now, they're not. So we have to take a look at these characters. We are going to see, by the way, over the course of this shiur, some very surprising things. And a comment about Jewish education, which we're going to be paneling about later on after lunch. But an important comment about Jewish education. Every year I teach my 10th graders during this season. I teach them Megillat Esther. And we teach it as the course. We're studying Sefer Shmuel. We take a break at the beginning of the second semester, which began last week. And from now till Purim, we study Megillat Esther Be'iyun. And every day I get the following three reactions. Not the ones you'd expect, which are... right? Because they don't have to fly all night. I get one reaction, which is this. Then I get another reaction, which is... and then I get this reaction. And I'll tell you what they are. This reaction is... because my whole life I grew up imagining Ahasuerus as a fat, ugly, stupid buffoon, drunk. And now you're telling me that's not the case. Because we don't like to have our cherished beliefs challenged. And by the way, we grew up our whole lives. Tell me what Mordechai looks like. What does Mordechai look like? Mordechai's an old man. Good, because there are no young men in Tanakh, right? He's got a beard, sure.
And he wears a medallion.
What, Mordechai. Mordechai. He's got a turban, right? Good. And he's got payas. I know. I've seen all the books. He's got payas. He's got tzitzis. And by the way, you can see who wrote the book to tell which kind of tchelet he has. The Rambam, the Ravid. Right? He's got tchelet, right? And of course, he does not show up there on Shabbos. Or if he does show up there on Shabbos, he's got his things tied like a key. He's got the whole patent. Everything set up. It's not the case. He described Esther. Now, the reason that you get that angry look, followed by, these are sort of Kubler-Ross's stages of learning Tanakh, followed by this, is that there's anger. When people have an image of things and you challenge the image, the first response is a resistance and an anger. The second thing that happens is kind of an excitement, something new. But the excitement is also born of youthful rebellion. Because now I'm going to go back to my other rabbis and I'm going to tell them what this guy said and see if we can create a fight in the faculty. It hasn't happened. And then this is, of course, they got to take notes because they can't just come back and say, is it true that, I forgot what it was, so they have to write it down. And this is what happens. But you take an honest look at the text and you see that the text is describing things in a particular way. And it's not hard to decide for what that way is or why it happened that way. And then you have to ask a question which is well beyond the scope of this year, which is why rabbinic tradition, and as a result of that, the little Midrash says, and as a result of that, what we all grew up with as little children as the story, is so extremely different in some cases, or shall we say, extreme versions of the characters that we read in the Megillah. There are reasons for that, but that belongs to a whole different conference and certainly to a different hour. Take a look at page 1. You can see the dates that are listed. In any case, the point I wanted to make from the issue of teaching my high school students is that we have very juvenile approaches to health when we're little kids. You know, mommy kisses it, it's going to get better. We have juvenile approaches to a lot of things when we're kids. Cooties. I don't know if they have cooties in Canada. They were probably banned because they're discriminatory. But in any case, we have all sorts of things. As we grow up, we learn to take a more sophisticated approach to life. We may still believe in cooties, but we're not going to actually act based on that. We have a more sophisticated attitude towards astronomy, towards math, towards commerce, towards responsibility, etc. In many, many cases, the most important part of our lives, which is our spirituality and our understanding of Tanakh, doesn't grow with us. It remains, as my Rosh Hashiv and Karim Biavni used to say, of Goldbach Zatzal used to say, people still think of Chanukah as walking around with a little candle on your head. And they don't mature into looking at it in a more sophisticated way. Interestingly enough, the Midrashim are far easier to teach children than the text. Because the Midrashim present caricatures. Haman is not only all evil, but he's laughably evil and sinister. And Mordechai is not only good, he's great from the get-go. The complexity of characters is far more found in the original text than in the Midrashim. And there are very important and holy reasons why the Midrashim do what they do. We're going to look at the text. First thing to understand about Megillat Esther is we have to get a time frame. The time frame is critical. Take a look at the page, and on your own you can see, everybody have their hand up? Okay. Take a look at the page, you can see on page 1, conveniently located in the back of page 2, you can see a calendar of events, as it were, a chronology of the events that are critical for understanding Megillat Esther. Now I will say from the get-go, I'm utilizing here what we call standard chronology. The kind of chronology that if you go to any history textbook, ask any historian, study in any university course of history, they're going to give you these dates, more or less. There is a rabbinic midrash, Seder Olam, which cuts out about 160 years out of the Persian Empire for reasons that are way beyond what we can do here. And as a result of that, the story of the Megillah takes place in a whole different framework. We're not going to be working with that model today. In the year 597 BCE, according to everything that we know historically, the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem 100+ years after the Assyrians tried. And what did they do to the king? What did they do to the king in 597? They exiled him honorably. And they exiled the aristocracy from Jerusalem. What did they do to the temple? They left it standing. And they left the Kohanim working there, and everything was fine. They installed a puppet king who was a cousin of the real king. Therefore, he was also a descendant of David, and therefore a rightful heir to the throne. His name was Mataniah. They changed his name to Tzidkiah. And they said, be a good boy and things will go well. And for 8 years, Tzidkiah was a good boy. Then he started listening to some voices. Some false prophets who said, if you sign a treaty with Egypt, you can overthrow the Babylonians. There was one good prophet there, a guy named Jeremiah, not a bullfrog. And he told them, let's see how old you are, and he told them, don't listen to them, we're supposed to submit to Babel, do it and you will be fine. He did not listen, signed a treaty with Egypt, and that winter, 588 BCE, the king of Babylonia came and built a siege around the city. The city was besieged for 2.5 years until the summer of 586. They broke through the walls, and 3 weeks later or so, on somewhere in the first week or so of Av, destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, destroyed the city, etc. Now, the Jews were allowed to return a mere 47 years later because the Babylonian Empire was overthrown and destroyed by an amalgamation of Medes and Persians, led by a particular man named Cyrus, a chieftain named Cyrus, whose name in Hebrew is Koresh. Not to be confused with that guy from Waco, Texas. Koresh, don't remember, David Koresh, okay. Koresh overthrew the Babylonians and then immediately announced that any of the peoples who had been enslaved and had been transferred to the center of in Mesopotamia could go back to their homes, rebuild their homeland,
speak their language, rebuild their religious temples, worship in their own way, and have an autonomous life in their homeland under two conditions. Condition one, taxes. Condition two, don't rebel. Otherwise, you're fine. And they had members of their own community appointed as governors over them. And so, therefore, Yehud Medinta, which was the legal name, the juridical name for the area of Judea, Yehud Medinta, Medinat HaYehudim, basically, or Medinat Yehuda, was governed by a scion of David by the name of Zerubbabel and Shealtiel. At the very beginning, even before Zerubbabel was sent, there was another Jew by the name of Sheshbatzar. If you look in the first chapter of Ezra, Koresh took all of the vessels out of the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. He took them out of the pagan temple, gave them to Sheshbatzar, and sent them to Jerusalem. So they were already out of Babel, they were already in Jerusalem. And two emperors later, under Dariavesh, in the year 515 BCE, the temple was finally completed, and on the third day of Adar, in 515 BCE, it was dedicated. That Dariavesh was a successful emperor until the year 485 BCE. When he died, there was a fight for succession, and Xerxes, who we believe to be the Ahasuerus of the Megillah, probably, took over and established his rule. Which means by now there is a Jewish community, not thriving, but there is a Jewish community in Judea. Ezra has not yet come to bolster the community. Nehemiah has not yet arrived to help rebuild the walls. But there is a Jewish community, there is a Beit HaMikdash, there are Kohanim, there is Avodah going on, but the majority of the community is sitting in Bavel. Actually, it's not Bavel anymore, because Dariavish moved the capital from Elam to Susa, Shushan. And that's where Ahasuerus made his throne. Let's meet Mordechai. Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBirah. You don't know how to say it. Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBirah. All right, there's a man who's a Yehudi. By the way, why is he called a Yehudi? After all, we know he's not from Shevet Yehuda. Why is he a Yehudi? Because what? Exactly, because he's from Judea, which is what the Goyim know. That's the area. So he's an Ish Yehudi. They refer to them as Guvrin Yehudain. Right, very good. Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBirah. Ushmo Mordechai. We're going to talk about his name. Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Yemini. Now, I got a problem with this pasuk. I read Tanakh. I'm familiar with Tanakh. And by the way, that's the difference between the Yahoo in Hamilton and the rest of us. The Yahoo in Hamilton doesn't know Tanakh. They're just cables out, so he's reading a book. Even if he knows the Bible, he doesn't read it with the same critical eye that we've been trained to because we learn Tanakh. We don't just read the Bible. We don't just read scriptures. We learn Tanakh. And so we read it sensitively and critically. When we read the introduction of a character in Tanakh, how is that character introduced? When you meet a character, what are we told about him? Thank you. How much of a genealogy? In Divrei Hayamim, occasionally we'll go all the way back to the Avot. That's rare. Usually, what kind of genealogy will you get? What? His father's and his shevet, at most. Sometimes you don't even get his father. Sometimes we get a grandfather when it's critical. Pinchas, Ben Elazar, Ben Aharon HaKohen. But that's critical because we have to know that he's the connection to Aaron and therefore he's going to now become a Kohen. Usually we're given just his name, often a Shevet, sometimes the patronym, or sometimes we'll get a super long lineage, by the way, not in early texts, only the Ramim, a super long lineage that takes us all the way back to the Avot. Here we have a weird lineage. It is, as we say in Yiddish, not a chicken and not a rabbit. Nishtahin, nishtaher. It's not a simple lineage. It's a simple lineage, and yet it's complex. It's multiple generations, but it's not a super long lineage either. It's a three generations back. Now, I would understand if Mordechai's father was some very, very big shot, and his grandfather was the Rashke Mahag, the chief rabbi of the world, and the father behind before that was the guy whose name was on all the plaques on all the shuls. I would understand why you want to mention his name. Because I understand it comes from Yichus. Mordechai ben Yair. Who's Yair? Correct, we don't know. Ben Shimi, well, this can't be the same Shimi who kicked the stuff at David. Right? First of all, the generations are no good. Second of all, why would you want to mention that here? Ben Kish. Who's Kish?
Well, if Kish is Shaul's father, then each one of these guys is living 300 years. I don't think so. So what we have here, by the way, is a phenomenon that's not surprising. Well, say it again. They chop generations. So this is Kish, Shaul's father. Well, why are you picking these three guys? If you're skipping generations, then what are you going to say? She is the great-granddaughter of John F. Kennedy, who was the great-great-grandson of, you're going to skip because the ones you're going to mention are really important. I'm sorry, but I don't know who these guys are. All right? One thing that becomes clear, just as a cultural phenomenon, is that, you know how particular families have names that run through the family? Because there's some answer. In our family, Yosef is a big name. Because Yosef Yoel Rivlin was the builder of the neighborhoods in Yerushalayim. He's my great-great-grandfather, so my Bechor's name is Yosef. A lot of Yosefs in our family. That's one of those names. We find that this is an ancient tradition. The tribe of Binyamin had names that repeated. Kish, there's at least two Kishes. Shimi, there's at least two Shimis. Yair is a name associated with the children of Rachel, Yair HaGiladi. So then there are names that pop up. But then you've got to ask the question, why are we picking these three names if they're not that famous? I'm going to ask you a different name question. Yair, is that a good Jewish name, good Hebrew name? Yair? Good name, right? Right? Shimi, good Hebrew name?
Yeah.
Kish? It is, by the way, Kish. Right? Someone knocks on the door, Kish. But we know it's a good Hebrew name, Shaul ben Kish. My problem is not with the ancestors. My problem is with Mordechai. What kind of name is Mordechai? It's kind of like naming your kid Jesus. Nah, Jesus is a Jewish name. It's kind of like naming your kid Buddha. Marduk is the name of the god of creation throughout Mesopotamia. And there, by the way, the fact that the name Mordechai does not show up in Tanakh until this point also indicates it's not a Jewish name. But we know what the name is. He's not the only one. So I got to figure out what happened here. But I got a bigger problem. Look at the next pasuk. So I got a bigger problem and why the hero of the story is named Buddha? Okay. Look at the next pasuk. Asher hogla miYerushalayim. He was exiled from Yerushalayim. Ima gola asher hogla im yechonya melech Yehuda. You want me to lay it in Echatrop, right? He was exiled from Yerushalayim with the exile of Yehoyachin. Wait. Yehoyachin was 597 BCE. These events, we're going to pick up the story here in the year 482 BCE. That's 115 years later. So Mordechai was exiled in 597, and he's still not only hanging around, but he's still relatively youthful, it seems. What happened? Read the pasuk again. Who was exiled? Thank you. And now I understand why it's Mordechai, Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, because what am I trying to link him back to? To the exile. What? Established, Kish is the one who was exiled, which means, by the way, Shimi was a first generation Shushanite. Yair was a second-generation Shushanite. And Mordechai is a third generation. Now, why am I saying this? Because I want to ask you a phenomenon that we are all familiar with. Yeah, but tell me about process. This is a sociological phenomenon that has been well documented. When our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, whoever it is you have, first came from the Alterheim, whether the Alterheim is Eastern Europe or Vancouver, wherever it is. Sorry, if it's from Eastern Europe. When they first came here to these shores, whatever part of these shores they came to, where did they live? Where did they move to when they first came? Lower East, whatever kind of Jewish ghetto. Religious or not, this is true. What did they speak? Yiddish. They were very traditional, even if not observant. They had, in many cases, a tremendous mistrust for anybody outside of their clan. And by the way, that included Jews outside of their clan. A famous story I heard from friends in Seattle. In the early part of the 20th century, when a group of Syrians came to Seattle, they came to the shul, the old shul downtown on Yesler Avenue. And they wanted to daven there. And the first question they asked them was, "Derets Yiddish?" And when they couldn't speak Yiddish, they said they must be goyim. They sent them away. There's a tremendous amount of clannishness, which is understandable because we've just been uprooted, we've just moved, we have to stick together. Now, what happens to their adult children who moved with them?
They kind of stay in that. But what happens to their children who are either very young or were born in the new country? What happens to them? So in American terms, they grow up in the Lower East Side. They go to PS whatever. They go to public school. They teach their parents how to fill out the driver license form or whatever it is they need to do. They teach their parents some English. The kids themselves speak with a terrible accent because they live in two worlds torn apart. And they pretty much stay in that area. And they maintain a very strong traditional sense. They'll never marry out. And they'll always have a seder. They may not be from it. They'll always... What happens to their kids? And the third generation already will have names like Chrissy and Ashley and Kimberly and Christina. Right? That's what you see in front of you. Okay? Now, that's not the only one we're going to see as we follow along. Who is this Mordechai raising? What's her name? Her name is Hadassah. What did they say when she was born, when they went into the Beit Knesset in Shushan? Hadassah. And yet, what does everybody else call her? Esther. And that's the name that everybody calls her throughout the Megillah. By the way, Esther is also not a name that's ever shown up before. Oh, since then, we've got lots of Esthers. Right? I have a friend whose daughter's name is Esther Malka. I don't know when she was born, but it's a great name. What is Esther? What? Astarte. Ashtoret. Ishtar. Throughout the Middle East, there's a goddess of fertility who's got that name. By the way, that is the word, a Babylonian word, that later comes into Latin as Astra, and as a result of that, astronomy, etc., because, and this is Chazal say, why was she called Esther? One of the explanations is Al-Shum Istahar, meaning the star. And the way that Rashi takes it, she's beautiful as a particular star, but the idea is that there's a certain pagan association here. So now, we're talking about an exile community that has already assimilated quite successfully. And you know what the best proof that they've assimilated successfully is? They're still there. Because think about it. The prophet already showed up and said, it's time to go home. The emperor said, here's money. Go build your Beit HaMikdash. Here's some lambs. Offer them up. Go. He said, nah, it's good here. We're staying. It's cool. Read the Kuzari. Second Ma'amar of the Kuzari, starting from paragraph 20 and on. Rabbi Yehuda Levi says out loud, he said, this is the greatest shame in the Jewish history. That when the opportunity to come knocks and we ignore it. So here we have Esther. Now, what does Esther look like? Oh, we all know what Esther looks like. She's got a Beis Yaakov uniform. Come on. All right. Esther is very beautiful, and she is taken, and evidently taken by force, to the palace. And by the way, in that, she is compared to a figure from Bereishit. Sorry. Very good. Now, Esther is in the palace for how long before her night with Ahasuerus? Remember what the rule was? A year, full year. 6 months in this oil, 6 months in that oil, for a whole year. And by the way, this is a palace that, as we know, has lots of spies, lots of eyes, lots of ears. So she did not make any fancy request. She said, whatever Hegai, the guy who's in charge of the women, recommends, that's how I'll go. I'll go in that dress. I'll go with that perfume, etc. And everybody liked her. Why? That's part of a different shiur why Esther was so successful. Vashti, you pay attention, never disappears. Vashti might be dead, she might be cleaning toilets, I don't know, but Vashti never disappears off the stage. Because whoever rules in place of Vashti always has the memory of what happened to Vashti hanging over her. Certain colleagues that I have who make the foolish mistake of becoming shul rabbis. Baruch Hashem.
but have been in situations like that, where they've walked into a shul where the last person who was there just got beaten up badly, and they're just walking into a situation where the scepter of that history hangs over everything that they do. It doesn't usually work well. The king made a big party. There's more girls coming. Which again is the scepter of Vashti hanging over. What does the Midrash say? Mordechai, after she's been crowned, sees more girls coming. What does he figure? Must have killed her too. Mordechai Yosef Bishar Melech, listen to this. Ein Esther Mageret Molata V'Yetama. Meaning what? Esther does not do what? She does not tell anybody, including and most specifically Achashverosh, that she is Jewish or that she's related to Mordechai, Molata. Now, how do you get away with that for a year? What does she do? What does she eat? What does she do every Friday night and Saturday? What does she do every Pesach? The one Pesach. What does she do?
Do you really want to ask that question?
No, it's rhetorical. But thanks for catching me. That Ma'amar Mordechai Esther Osaka Shrei Tavim Na'ito. This, by the way, is an interesting turnabout because the king is going to end up doing Esther's dictate, which is dictated to her by Mordechai, which means some Jew on the outside of the palace is running the kingdom. It's an interesting little bit of irony. But here's the chap. Who do we have here? We have Mordechai, who we have yet to draw a picture of, but we got the sense of somebody who's already a third generation, somewhat assimilated. We've got an Esther who's able to successfully stay in the palace, and nobody knows she's Jewish. And by the way, it's not just for the year. Because when is Esther picked? In the seventh year of Achashverosh's rule. When do the events with Haman happen? In the 12th year. Which means Esther's now been in the palace for a year of preparation and 5 years of queenness. And nobody knows she's Jewish. So much for the Beis Yaakov uniform. So please turn the page. Yeah.
Why is she keeping her Jewishness a secret when Daniel, for example, succeeds because of it?
Good question. And that is really the topic for a different, I mean, that could have been a sort of a quasi-title for a second part of the shiur. Because a lot of the personalities of Mordechai and Esther and why they do what they do are intertwined. The text says very clearly, she does what Mordechai tells her. And Mordechai tells her not to. So the real question is, why did Mordechai tell her to be silent? So when she was in the process of getting picked, there is a huge machloket rishonim about why Mordechai told her not to give away her Judaism as an identity. One position, which is curious, is because Mordechai did not want her to get picked. And he was afraid that if she would tell them that she's related to Shaul and she comes from this royal family, she'd be an obvious choice. He wanted her not to get picked. However, most of the opinions go on the opposite side and say that we have a general understanding that there were not favorable feelings towards Jews. And if she told them she was Jewish, she would probably lose. And he wanted her to win. Why did he want her to win? That's a good question in itself. Did he have nivuah? And he knew, as per the Septuagint, and for the Alpha text, the expanded text of the Megillah, did he know that Esther was going to play a critical role and he had to get her into position? Unclear.
How else did he put her into those positions?
Well, he didn't put her, that's the thing. Vati lakach, she was taken. And remember, they were grabbed up. It wasn't like, sign up here. Uncle Achashverosh wants you. It was, yeah. So turn the page. I apologize. I put things a little bit out of order, but I did it for a reason because I wanted to keep everything on page 2 together. Here's the scene we need to get to. And in faithful form, we're getting to it right in time. Acharad Vraim Ha'ilet. Please don't make noise. Gidel HaMelech Achashverosh. What's his name? All right? Achashverosh raises to be great, but Hamdata HaGagi. Who Haman is and the issue of Amalek, third shear. I have to come back. Keep some of that white stuff on the ground for me. What did Achashverosh do with Mr. Man? On Shabbat, I was telling my kids, as we were about to make Hamotzi, so I took the Lacha Mishnah and I said, Bnei Yisrael were in the Midbar. Shabbat Kishalach. Bnei Yisrael were in the Midbar. We were hungry. And so what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? Shalach, we just speak in Hebrew. Shalach lanu et haman. Immediately my kids started yelling. He made Haman's chair higher than the other ministers. What does that mean? What? He elevated his power above the rest of the ministers. Now, you got to step back. And by the way, one thing when you study Megillat Esther, you cannot leave behind, you cannot park, is whatever you know about human psychology, about relationships, you cannot ignore. They are so critical in understanding what happens in the Megillah. You are the finance minister of Persia. You have had the king's ear for lo these many years, or months, or whatever. And suddenly, out of nowhere, seemingly, comes this guy. And suddenly, he has the king's ear on everything. How do you feel? Jealous, resentful. You're not a happy camper. Keep that in mind. This is the part we want to get to. All of the servants of the king are korim mishtachavim. By the way, what does korim mishtachavim mean? What does it mean? It doesn't mean aleinu. It means you put your knees on the ground and put your head down. That's korim. And then mishtachavim, as we see from Batsheva, means you're all the way on the ground. I have to say this word correct. Prostrate. Always mix it up. But you're lying prostrate on the ground. That's what everybody has to do. V'chol avdei hamelach. Who? What is the order? Who has to lie that way in front of Haman? What did we grow up with as kids? What was the image? Anybody, right? Haman walked somewhere, anybody had to hit the floor. It's not true. What does it say? Avdei hamelach asher b'shar hamelach. Where's Shar hamelach? What is Shar hamelach? The gate. What is the gate of the palace? What's the function of the gate in the palace? And it's not, no, but what happens at the gates of the palace? In other words, it's the royal offices. This is where everybody's working. The Shar Ha'ir. That's where Boaz goes to make the deal. That's where the Shoftim sit, the Shar Ha'ir. So we are now at the gates of the palace, which is where the officers sit. Anytime Haman walks by, what do they have to do? They have to hit the deck. Kichen tzivalo ha-melech. U-Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai refuses to participate in this. Now, of course, the big question is why? And I'm going to make the question much worse. Let's hear what you think. Why is Mordechai not bowing down? Go ahead. What? You only bow before Hashem. Okay, except for Moshe Rabbeinu bowing before Yitro, and except for Batsheva bowing before David, and except for every other example that's possible. So it is not true that we only bow before Hashem. We bow before people out of respect all the time. We don't, because in our society, that's kind of not how we show respect anymore. Right? But in the Tanakh, left and right, people are bowing, well, usually forward, people are bowing down. That's exactly what Batsheva did when she came and seated David. That's how we know what Hishtachava is from Batsheva, Perak Aleph from Malachim Aleph. Yeah. Uh-huh. Ah, great question. Excellent question. She's saying Mordechai didn't have to bow down because he wasn't an officer of the court. Now I'll prove to you that he probably was an officer of the court. In the previous passage we saw on the first page, we saw that Esther was taken in and Mordechai was sitting at the palace gates. Mordechai cannot be sitting at the palace gates unless he's got a job. He has to in some way be affiliated with the court. By the way, recently they found an archaeological record from the kingdom of Xerxes listing as a relatively low-level tax collector some Jew named Marduk. Got to be him, because archaeology always works on our side, right? But, you know, could be. In any case, he evidently was a member of the court. And by the way, I'll tell you a secret. He had spies inside. Don't tell. Mordechai had spies and eyes inside the palace. Because, let me ask you this. He's sitting outside of the palace, wanting to know what's happening to Esther. For a whole year, how is Esther? How's he going to find out? He doesn't have x-ray vision. Right? Krypton has not yet exploded, so he doesn't have x-ray vision. How's he going to know what's happening inside the palace? Evidently, he's got some eyes inside the palace who are reporting to him because he's a member of the court and he knows how to play the game. Bitan Vateresh. How did he find out about Bitan Vateresh? So I could prove it to you. I'll give you a short version of how I could prove to you that Mordechai, that Bitan Vateresh happened the same way. Mordechai had ears inside the palace. If you take a look, it's not on the page, but we all know the story. Mordechai gets Esther's attention. And through walking down the street in torn clothes, Esther sends out Hatach to find out what happens. What does he do? He tells Hatach what Haman told Ahasuerus, and it says specifically about the money. And then he shows Hatach a copy of the decree to kill the Jews. I got a problem. What happened with the money? Haman said to Ahasuerus, I'll give you 10,000 talents of silver. What did the king say? The king, quoting the New York Post, said, forget about it. Which means there is no money. So what is Mordechai telling Esther? Well, part of the reason is because he's trying to tell Esther that Haman's lying to Ahasuerus. But how does Mordechai know about the money? The decree doesn't say anything about money. Evidently, he's got some spies on the inside, which is exactly how he hears about Bitan Vateresh. He's got ears in the palace because he knows he's got to keep an eye on what's going on, especially with Esther there. So now, why doesn't Mordechai bow down? So we tried the possibility, which was an intriguing possibility, that he wasn't obligated to bow down. But then the rest of the story kind of collapses. Because then when the courtiers say to Mordechai, why aren't you bowing down? He would say, I don't have a job here. I don't have to. So why doesn't he bow down? Oh, good, good, good. Excellent. So take a look at page one. And our friend quotes the Ibn Ezra, the second comment under the big text. That he had some sort of sign of Avodah Zarah on his clothes or on his hat. And that's a quote from the Midrash that's right directly under that. Rashi, on the other hand, has a different take, quoting from a different Midrash, which is that Haman declared himself to be a god. Now, why are both of these somewhat implausible within Pshat? Because what is it that Haman's trying to do? Why is Haman interested in getting everyone to bow down to him? Power, ego. If instead he masks that as a form of worship, then he doesn't gain anything. If he carries a cross, put it in contemporary terms, and says everybody's got to bow down to the cross, then he's just the guy holding the cross. He hasn't gained anything. And if he calls himself a god, then they're just bowing to a god, not to him. But far worse. Do you think there's any way in the world that Ahasuerus is going to allow one of his cabinet members to declare himself a god? I don't think so. Very difficult. There's a fascinating midrash that shows up in Otzar Midrashim of Eisenstein, which really comes from the Targum Sheni of Esther. It's an ancient text going back to the Goenic period. It's an entire story of how, it's actually earlier, based on a much earlier tradition, that Mordechai, I'll give you the short version of it, Mordechai and Haman were both generals in Ahasuerus' army. Great story. And Haman, of course, ate up all the Snickers bars. And all the rations. And Mordechai, as a wise man, rationed out his food. So they're out at some way off in India fighting a war. And Haman came to Mordechai and said, I need some food. So Mordechai, make his long story short, Mordechai said to Haman, I'm not going to give you any food. You used up all your food. Haman says, I'll sell me to you as a slave if you give me the food. So Mordechai said, fine. And they wrote a star on Haman's leg that he belongs to Mordechai. And every time that Haman would come out, now that Haman had been raised up, every time that Haman came out, Mordechai would say, bow down to him. He's my slave.
which, by the way, makes the whole thing far more intriguing and far more problematic from a, not just halachic, but from a nationalistic perspective. Whatever answer we give, we're going to have the following problem. When Mordechai finds out, and by the way, Mordechai used to go like this to Haman, point to the left. Whatever answer we give as to why Mordechai didn't bow down, because of idolatry, because of the idol he was carrying, because he used to be a slave, because he wasn't officially a member of the court, whatever answer we give is going to suffer from the following challenge. When Mordechai found out, and he did, that Haman was so angry at him, he was going to make sure that all the Jews were wiped out, what should Mordechai, by rights, have done to Haman? Should have come, said, bow down. I'm sorry, I didn't see. Like Reagan, it was this year. I didn't hear very well. I didn't know. Please forgive me. He used to be president in the United States. Please forgive me. 1,000 pardons. You know, and genuflect and do everything necessary. Instead, what does Mordechai do? Refuses to bow down. And it continues on. Haman comes out after the first party, famously. And it's not on the page, but Haman comes out after the first party with Esther feeling fantastic. And there's Mordechai in the middle of this whole tragedy about to take place. And he refuses to move. So there's one more thing about Mordechai, and then I want to get to an answer. As far as I'm concerned, it's 9:30, so I'm fine. Got another 3 hours to lunch. One other thing about Mordechai. Let's read a couple more psukim. Vayomru avdei ha-melech asher v'shar ha-melech l'mordechai madu ata uveret mitzvat ha-melech. So the other courtiers said to Mordechai, why are you violating the king's word? Which means, by the way, what are they accusing him of? Sedition, treason, yeah. Vahi kum rame lav yom vayom. And they said to this, day after day they said this. V'lo shema aleihem, he didn't listen. V'yagiru l'haman, and finally they went and told Haman, which by the way raises another problem. How come Haman didn't see right away that Mordechai wasn't bowing down? Why did it take the courtiers to come and say, oh, by the way, that Jew over there isn't bowing down? But v'yagiru l'haman, l'ro'ota yamdu divrei Mordechai, ki gid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Now they went to Haman and said, this guy's not bowing down. And why did they go? What does the text say? Why did they go? Because he told them he was Jewish. So now, before we get to the big question was, which is, what does it mean? Like, why did that make them go? Tell me what Mordechai looks like. The text makes it very clear. What does Mordechai look like? He looks like a regular Persian guy. Nobody knows he's Jewish until he says he's Jewish. Now, the fact that he says he's Jewish, as tied in with why he's not bowing down, is that incidental or causal is a different question. But why do they now run to Haman? They didn't run to Haman before. Before, they want to say, come on, like, come on, bow down. Come on, bow down. We'll all get in trouble. Come on. And now he says, I'm Jewish. Oh, let's go tell Haman. Why? Why does that motivate them to go run and tell Haman? What? Yeah, but why does that make them go and tell Haman? Till now, day after day, they didn't tell Haman there's a guy not bowing down. Now that he says that he's Jewish, they go and tell Haman he's not bowing down. Well, the Jews aren't yet in trouble. This is what's going to get them in trouble. Unless you want to say Jews are just always in trouble. Right, which is certainly possible. Yeah. Yeah, but you mean they're going to ask Haman a Shaila? If a guy says he's Jewish, does that make it mutter from him? Yeah. Yeah, then it would have been by Yishalu at Haman, I think. But Gino Haman seems like they're ratting on him. But now they're going to make things worse. Now they're going to end up with the yeah. Could be. I've never heard that possibility, but it's certainly possible. I would have said one of two things. Possibility one is we found out who the real anti-Semites are. It's not Haman. We found out who the real anti-Semites are. The real anti-Semites are the other members of the court. They don't like that this Jew is on the court. And now, aha, we got a way to get rid of him. Look at this. He's not bowing down. The minute he says he's Jewish, we're going to get rid of him. Possibility two is, I don't know how many of you remember this from high school, but in certain high schools, it's very common if people would end up pushing each other on the yard, suddenly in half a second, you'd have fight, fight, fight. And then everybody would come around, and the two guys he pushed in, they don't want to fight, but they're being pressured into it. It could be that the Avdei HaMelech are trying to create a confrontation between Haman and Mordechai because they know that Haman doesn't like Jews. And they themselves, remember what we said at the beginning, maybe they don't like Haman. And maybe they think, you know what, this guy might have a chance to take him down. So let's push the two of them together because what are the words? L'ra'ot ha'yamdu divrei Mordechai. Let's see who is going to win. Possibility. In any case, we've got a picture that's very incomplete. And I'm going to make a plug right now before we get to the answer. I mentioned that I have a podcast that you can follow that's going to be going till Purim twice a week on Megillat Esther. And in it, I'll get to the answer of why Mordechai and Esther look the way they do and how they look at the end of the story. You'll have to listen. But as far as our particular question, why Mordechai didn't bow down. Remember I mentioned earlier on that the author of Megillat Esther will use terms, phrases, scenes, settings that are similar to earlier books in the Tanakh to create an allusion and a comparison. John Levinson, in his masterful work on Megillat Esther, points out that the scene where the courtiers are talking to Mordechai about bowing down is eerily similar to another scene involving the first Jew in a foreign court. And who is the first Jew in a foreign court? Yosef. And by the way, the Yosef story has much in common with Megillat Esther, the handing over of the ring, the power over everything, the Mishneh LaMelech, etc. Take a look at this scene. I'm going to read from the left-hand column on the bottom. Follow me on the right-hand column. Vahi achar hadvarim ha'ela, after these things, vatisa eshet Adonav etenehah al Yosef. His mistress cast her eyes on Yosef, vatoma shichva imi. She said, lie with me. Vayimaein, he refused. Similar to Mordechai. Also, Vashi. And Vashi, I believe, is an Ur model for Mordechai. I think Vashi is more of a hero than the maker out to be. Vayomer leishet Adonai, v'hein Adonai lo yada itima babayit, v'chol asher yishlo natan biyadi. I have been given total trust here. Einenu gadol babayit hazeh mimeni, v'lo chasach mimeni me'uma, ki motach v'asher at ishto, v'ech eser v'agdol azor v'chatati l'Elohim. Yosef presents his refusal to bow down as a sign of his loyalty to his master. Not his refusal because he doesn't like her, and not because of his refusal even on moral grounds as much as on ethical grounds of his allegiance to his master. Vayhi kedabra el Yosef yom yom. See it? Just like as they spoke to Mordechai yom yom. V'lo shamay leha v'shkav etzal v'yotim, I refused to lie with her. Notice the comparisons. What ends up happening? Yosef ends up running out in the street without his clothes. Just like Mordechai, after this decree, is walking through the street in torn clothes. The comparisons are very eerie. And I'd like to make the following suggestion as to why Mordechai did not bow down to Haman. It will surprise you. If you take a look back at the beginning of Perek Gimel, you will see that Haman is ordered that everyone bow down to him, and it says ki chen etziva lo hamelech. That word lo is a little bit awkward. What should it say? Ki chen etziva alav. Oh, hamelech. Or alav hamelech. Ki chen etziva lo hamelech makes it sound like this is what Haman is claiming. The king told me this. We don't know it's true. You know what Mordechai is doing? He's not bowing down because he says bowing down is an act of sedition. Are you nuts? You expect me to bow down to a member of Ahasuerus' court? That is treasonous. I refuse to do so just as Yosef refused to submit to Mrs. Potiphar because that is sedition against my master. And you understand now why Mordechai, even with the decree coming up, stands his ground. He doesn't stand his ground because he says, this guy was my slave, or some halacha and avodah zarah. He stands his ground because he says, you guys don't get it. Haman is a traitor to the king. And by making this demand, he is demonstrating his treachery. And by the way, guess what? Haman ends up dying a traitor's death because he does exactly what Mordechai is accusing him of. He tries to usurp Ahasuerus's crown. And how does he do it in action? He tries to jump the queen in the king's palace. And so Mordechai simply has caught on to Haman earlier than anyone else and has said, this is why I refuse to bow. Over the course of the last hour and 5 minutes, I introduced you to Megillat Esther, some of the methodology of study of Megillat Esther, some of the flexibility that the authors had with translating and the utilization of earlier texts in Tanakh to draw allusions, comparisons, and contrasts. We studied through several of the texts of Megillat Esther to see a picture of who the heroes are and what they look like. And then I told you, you got to keep listening to find out more. And then we went through the sugya of why Mordechai did not bow down to Haman. We went through some of the traditional answers and demonstrated where there are some difficulties there. And then I suggested the answer that Mordechai's refusal to bow to Haman was indeed really a demonstration of his tremendous loyalty to Ahasuerus, which the text bears out, because in the end, Haman dies a traitor's death. Thank you. Are there any questions? How many have questions? Yeah, what's your name?
At the end, he's pushed, and it looks like he's being a traitor in terms of trying to take advantage, but he was pushed. It wasn't something intentional, right?
What do you mean? What do you mean he was pushed?
I mean, he fell. Or in other words, it looked like he was trying to take advantage of Esther.
Yeah,
right? But it wasn't
good.
Intentional, right?
Excellent question. So what? Just a second. No, you asked a very good question. And I think what Chazal are saying when they say an angel came and pushed him so he'd fall on Esther is exactly this point. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to show Ahasuerus who the real traitor is. Right? Because after all, Haman, just the night before, tried to prove that Mordechai was a traitor and get him hanged. It didn't work. And now Haman, who's the real traitor, is in the palace. What do Chazal say? Ahasuerus got so mad, he walked out. What did he see outside? He saw servants uprooting his trees. He said, why are you doing this? Oh, Haman told us to. Malachi. He comes back into the palace, and what happens? Haman is leaning over Esther, and the Malach gives him a kick right where he belongs, and he falls on top of Esther, and just at that moment, the king walks in. What is the Midrash trying to tell us there? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is essentially exposing Haman for who he really is. He's somebody who's trying to usurp the throne. And what's the best proof for that? When Ahasuerus asks him in the middle of the night, what should I do for somebody I want to really honor? And Haman goes, I know that's me. What does he describe? He doesn't describe a parade in his honor. He describes a coronation of himself. The king's crown, the king's horse, etc. He's describing a self-coronation. So Ahasuerus has already got his number pegged. We all know what's going on. Haman's the last guy to have the Asimon drop and figure out what's going on. And by that time, his body drops with it, with his neck is left up on top.
Just to clarify, the translation you've given is that the king had so commanded concerning him, the bowing down.
Yeah, that's their translation.
Is your proposal that this is what Haman said, the king said,
right,
rather than what the king actually said?
Maybe the king said nothing. Or maybe the king just said to Haman, look, you want to do that bakasha, but I'm not making it a command. But I think Mordechai is essentially standing up and saying, I don't believe you. I do not believe the king would command such a thing. Parenthetically, to substantiate this, it is quite clear from the rest of Megillat Esther, we're taking questions, from Megillat Esther, that Ahasuerus was absolutely clueless of things going on outside the palace gates. By the way, so was Esther. And so Haman could get away with this. And Mordechai is the one who really stands to defend the king by saying, I'm not going to bow down to you. That's sedition. Okay, I believe we need to end. Lunch is upstairs.